Morning. An hour early. I was wondering how many people were going to show up an hour early, but here you are. Here you are. I hope your bodies adjust soon. It usually takes me about 3 weeks to get used to this. So today I'd like to talk about joy. My last talk I talked about the four immeasurables, loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity, but I only talked for a little while about each of them. So today I'd like to talk more about joy. So according to the story of Buddha, when he went over the wall of the palace enclave where he was treated so well into the big world, he first saw a sick person. I can't believe he'd never seen a sick person before, but this is a story, right? And this sick person was really full of sores, and flies were buzzing around, and depending on what version you read, some of the versions are more graphic than others, right? Then he saw an aged, decrepit person who was like 71 years old and bent over and barely could remember anything and barely could hear anything and barely could see anything. He thought, my God, my Brahma, he thought. And then he saw the funeral pyres with bodies burning. And then the fourth view that he had, the fourth person he saw was the sannyasin. And this was just a guy in dressed in orange who just seemed to radiate joy. Just radiate it. And that's, he said, I'm after that. I'm after that. And so that was the beginning of his quest. And then if we want to go with the story, at the end of the sixth year of his quest, while he was sitting, like we're sitting, of course, like we're sitting, he saw the morning star, it penetrated his heart, and he experienced an ineffable, indescribable happiness. It didn't seem to come from anywhere. It seemed to be everywhere. And that's then what he taught. That was the basis of his teaching for his whole life. Well, that's one version. That's the version for today, right? So, our Zen practice, our Buddhist practice, then, is how we can become experts in happiness. How we can become experts in happiness. Not experts in ritual. It's good to do ritual. It's cool. Not experts in understanding Buddhism. It's good. Not experts in anything in particular except happiness. Except happiness. So Thoreau, who was into this kind of thing, although he was not a formal Buddhist, you don't have to be a Buddhist to do this stuff, you know. Oh, I've been practicing my whole life. I only reconciled to the fact that I was a Buddhist about 10 years ago when I started ordaining people. And I thought, well, I guess I am a Buddhist. It's true. It's true. That's exactly true. So Thoreau said, surely joy is the condition of life. Surely joy is the condition of life. Surely it is. Surely it is. And I've been kind of lucky. I've been unlucky in my life too, but we've all been lucky and unlucky, haven't we? But my good lucky things was that in my 20s, I was with a teacher who seemed to emanate joy. Most of the time. It was underneath there most of the time. And then when I was in my 30s and my 40s, I was with another teacher, Katagiri Roshi, who seemed to emanate joy. And they weren't very similar, those teachers, those guys, but they were similar in that way. They were similar in that way. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the external concealers of joy. and the internal concealers of joy, and then something more about joy itself. So the external concealers of joy. I listed, let's see, how many did I list here? Four. You do your own list. These are my list of four. Four external concealers of joy. One, fast-paced society. Anybody know about that? Fast-paced society? Anybody know about computers and iPads and iPods and cell phones and all that text messaging? So every winter, I go to a very far-off place that's very hard to get to, a little tiny island in the middle of the ocean. And my idea was that it would be a place where things would be slowed down a little bit. But last time, my wife and I both took our cell phones, and we got text message when we were in the getting up in the morning. We got text message when we were going to bed at night. We got text message on the beach. I finally said to Linda, come on, let's get those cell phones away from us. And these are text messages from people in Minnesota, from people in Europe. Ding, right? The brain is an electrical entity. It's an electrical entity. So what do you think all this electrical stimulation effect it has on the brain and on our underlying innate joy? Something we need to pay attention to in our fast-paced society. There was a town in Scandinavia I read about 3 years ago, a small town of 200,000. They got the media to agree not to have any negative stuff on the media for 6 months. And it really had a big difference in people's lives. Now, I don't know what happened at the end of the 6 months. Maybe they just felt they were too out of tune with the rest of the world, you know, because you missed 10 text messages and you've missed out on everything. And of course, I could get into some of these other things, but I don't even do these other things that you guys do. Maybe I'll learn about them. Maybe my grandkids will teach me about them. Experiment that was done at Indiana University in 2011. They had an experimental group and they had a control group. These are teenagers. The experimental group, they had the teenagers play 10 hours of violent video games a week. And the control group did nothing. They did this for, I don't know how many weeks, I think 8-10 weeks. Then they did brain scans, and those who had played the 10 hours in video games had less activation in the left interior frontal lobe and in the anterior cingulate cortex, areas implicated in emotional regulation and aggressive behavior. And this pattern of reduced activity persevered after the second week, despite the fact that the gaming group had stopped playing the violent game. Interesting. Billable hours. Anybody in a profession that has any billable hours? And those of you who don't know about billable hours, you're lucky. Don't get into psychology. Don't get into social work. Don't get into therapy. Don't get into law. Don't get into nursing. Don't work for managed care. on and on and on. Billable hours. My friend got hired by a big time Minneapolis law firm out of law school. Big time. She was really excited, and she kind of loved it, but she also hated it because there was so much pressure for her billable hours, so much pressure. And then there was a lot of controversy about whether they could use toilet time as billable hours. And, well, if they could use toilet time as billable hours, was it ethical? And could they be thinking about their client while they were sitting on the toilet? I'm not kidding, you guys. I'm not kidding. So what does that do to us? What does that do to our fast pace? And how can we settle into the joy that's always here when we're where we're so consumed by this stuff. The last version, I don't know about the current one, but the last version of the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual that psychologists and psychiatrists use for diagnosing people, had extended grieving as a diagnosable disease, extended grieving. So we don't even have enough time to grieve. Our grandparents grieve sometimes. They wore black. My great-grandmother wore black for 5 years after her husband's death. And we'd say, oh, that's a stupid custom, but that was honoring. That was honoring her heart, the sadness in her heart. I'm still grieving for my dog Freckles' death in the fifth grade. That's abnormal. And sleep. 100 years ago, you guys have read this research probably. It's 100 years ago, the average amount of sleep that people got in the United States was 8 to 9 hours. Now it's 6 to 7 hours. For the average person, is getting 2 hours less sleep all night than 100 years ago. So those are interesting things about our fast-paced society that really need to bring us to the meditation cushion, I think. I hope. So that's one external concealer of joy, fast-paced society. Another is social isolation. We're socially isolated. You may not feel that way, but as Americans, in comparison with other cultures, we tend to be socially isolated. My wife and I and my kids had a graduate student from China living in our house when my kids were, I don't know how old, 10 and 12, I guess. And he was great. He was our friend. He cooked meals for us. Not like you get in Chinese restaurants. Real, you know. But he cooked Chinese meals for us. And he said, well, there were some things. I asked him once, well, what about this country seemed kind of weird to him? And he said, one thing he said, and this is not related to my talk, is the way children treat their parents. He was watching our kids and us. But the other thing he said is, oh, he said, you're so isolated. I never met your father. I never met your mother. I never met your brother. I never met your cousins. I never met your... Where are they? I said, oh, they're in California, and they're up in northern Minnesota, and they're... He said, really? We don't do that. He said, and look at your house. And we just live in a regular-sized Midwestern house. And he said, oh, we would have 15, 20 people living in this house. And it would be all our family. All our family. So we're isolated. You think you're lonely sometimes? This is the part of the situation we've created for ourselves in this culture. We have some good things about this culture, but these are things that make it hard for us to tap into our natural joy, to our Buddha-given joy, our no-Buddha-given joy. The Amish and a tribal group in New Guinea in cross-cultural studies have the lowest incidence of depression of any cultures. And they are tight. They are tight. Meaning their family, their tribe, their interconnectedness is tight. Tight in a good way. Tight in a good way. Maybe tight in a bad way too, but that's not what the study is about. Finally, I got two more external physical inactivity. In 1900, 90% of folks in this country made their livings with their bodies. In 90%, now less than 10%, and you know it's getting less and less and less and less and less. I think by the end of the century, who knows? But it's so our bodies, being in our bodies. Being active in our bodies. And of course, those of you who've studied Zen know that the birth of Zen in China is almost paired with emphasis on physical labor, manual labor, and the joy that comes out of that. Not just as a Puritan deal, but as the joy of just giving yourself to the activity. And the fourth one is consumer culture. We have a consumer culture, in case anybody hasn't noticed. And Buddha's whole thing is that the problem of human existence is that we're striving to get this, get that, get the other, to fill up our pain, our psychological pain, and then we're pushing away those things that we can't get. But our whole consumer culture is based on grabbing stuff to fill up that pain. So it really, Buddhist practice is a counterculture to our dominant culture in many ways. It's a counterculture, which is wonderful, and it's wonderful that so many people are interested in it. It's not exactly like the counterculture I did in the 60s, but I think this is more healthy culture than that culture. A little more healthy. Not as aromatic, but a little more. However, in spite of this fast-paced society, this social isolation, this physical inactivity, and this consumer culture, we're designed to weather stress. We're designed to weather stress. And I was talking about my teachers 10 minutes ago. My first teacher, Suzuki, stress big time in his life, huge. World War II, not enough food. One of his priests killed his wife. Came to this country after years of being in incredible stress. Incredible stress. Kataguri, the founding teacher here, not enough food to eat when he was 18, after the end of the war, not enough food. Living in the monastery, and they went out to collect weeds, to make weed soup to serve to the monks. Stress. So stress is nothing new. I think, and we're designed to weather stress. They weathered stress. We can weather stress, but we need downtime to do this, you guys. We need downtime. We need meditative time. Either do your meditative time here or do it somewhere else. Either do it in this form or do it in another form. If you want to tap into a wonderful joyousness that's always present, you have to do meditative time. So many of you know that I've retired a few months ago from a job that I had for years. And I said that, well, what I wanted when I retired, what I wanted to do was lead long retreats. That's mostly what I wanted to do. And someone said, is it because you like long retreats? And I said, no, not necessarily because I like long retreats. Just because I know from my years of practice and my years of working with peers and students that often it takes about 2 days, sometimes 3 days, of sitting quietly doing nothing for your mind to begin to calm down and for you to tap into wonderful stillness. It just does. But we don't have time for it, right? Isn't that the paradox, that we don't have time? We don't have enough vacation time. We don't have enough time. So but we're making the choice. You're making the choice about your life. You're making the choice. And of course, maybe you feel, you know, impinged on. Lots of times in my life I feel impinged on, like I don't have choice. But we do have choice. And our life's very short. Very short. So what about the internal concealers of joy? The internal smotherers of joy? Well, we know who the culprit is in Zen. Well, in Shakespeare, how about Shakespeare? Shakespeare, there is nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Ah, the internal concealer of joy says,
William Shakespeare. Thinking makes it so. The Dhammapada. And Shakespeare must have read the Dhammapada. I doubt it, but all that we are is the result of what we have thought. It is found in our thoughts. It is made up of our thoughts. So how do we open up to this joy that our thinking seems to conceal, that our monkey mind seems to conceal? And Dogen says it's through practice enlightenment. Not practice in order to get enlightenment, but practice enlightenment. Because practice in order to get enlightenment is stressful. You're revving up your brain, right? More brain activity. Practice enlightenment as one activity. Or Dogen also says actional realization. Practice enlightenment, actional realization. Through our activity, we break through the mold of encrusted thinking. We break through it by fully engaging. And it doesn't matter what the activity is, as long as it's got an ethical underpinning. If it's got ethical underpinning, it's based on interdependence. So I said the two common things about my two Japanese teachers, Suzuki Roshi and Katagiri Roshi, were that they both emanated a quiet joy, generally quiet, sometimes giggling, but generally quiet. Not boisterous, you know. Except in Sesshin, they both could get kind of boisterous. But it's not the kind of boisterousness that you think about. It's different. Different. The other thing that was common about them is that they really emphasized sitting meditation, which we would expect them to do. They really emphasized it. And they emphasized, come sit with me. Come sit with me, said Sensei Suzuki Roshi. Come sit with me, said Hojo-san Katagiri Roshi. Come sit with me. Come sit with me. And so I did. And I still do. And the other thing they used to say was, just get up. If you don't, when it's time to do zazen, just get up. So I was stupid enough just to do that. Just to do that year after year after year. Just get up. Just get up. Actional realization. Practice enlightenment. Just brush my teeth. Just brush my teeth. So we're lucky, I think, that we've got this opportunity. Pretty lucky. Wow. Wow. And lots of people and lots of cultures haven't had this kind of opportunity. Maybe they had a different opportunity. Maybe it hasn't been. So I was recently, and I don't know how I happened to be reading this, but I have grandkids who live in France, and and my son-in-law is French. So I was reading something about Rodin. You know Rodin, the French sculptor? So this is about Rodin and Rilke. So Rilke is an Austrian poet, Austrian mystical poet. He's a Zen poet, Rilke. He really is. Definitely a Zen poet. So Rilke is a younger man. Rodin's an older man. Rilke shows up in Paris. Everybody's going to Paris, you know, in the 1890s. It's a place to be, right? In the West, that is. Everybody's going to Paris. And they get to know each other, and Rilke becomes Rodin's secretary, because Rilke's not known, and Rodin is getting famous. You know, Rodin gets quite famous in his life. But Rilke comes to Rodin once, and he says, and I'm paraphrasing, really paraphrasing. He says, my mind is out of control. I'm really suffering. My thoughts are taking over there. I'm so anxious. So he uses Rodin as his mentor. And Rodin says, I guess he's empathic. Let's hope he's empathic. I'm mostly making this up. I did read this. But And he says, well, what I think you should do is go to the zoo every day and watch the animal. And he said, but I'm your secretary. And he said, yeah, but I also want you to, every day in the zoo, I'm giving you time to go watch the animals every day. So that's what that's what Rilke did. He went to the zoo every day and watched the animals. And it helped. And it helped. It helped. So, I want you to sit down every day and watch your animals. Watch your animals. Will you do that for me? Will you sit down every day and watch your animals? Don't feed them. Don't feed them. Just watch them. Watch them with an open heart and with some kindness. Just watch them every day. Every day. And remind yourself, too. Remind yourself, however silly reminder you need, that it's your nature to be joyful. Remind yourself. The Dhammapada, all that we are is the result of what we have thought. It is founded on our thought. It is made up of our thought. If a man acts with a pleasant thought, happiness follows him like a shadow that never leaves him. So, you're not too depressed to do this practice. You're not. You're not too anxious to do this practice. You're not too old to do this practice. You're not. You're not. We used to think that the brain finished developing by the time a child was 12 years old. At least according to something that I read on the, in the brain's Buddha and the brain, 12 years old. Now we know about the neuroplasticity of the brain. Now we know that the brain is continually making new connections, that our cells are programmed to die and be replaced, and that in 6 to 12 months we almost have a total rewiring going on. Every 6 to 12 months, total rewiring. So, your karma, I know about your karma before, I know about all this stuff, but what about now? What about now? And there's also research on genes, genetic. We've learned so much about genetic predispositions. Everybody is getting wigged out and depressed about genetic predispositions. But we're also learning that the effects of genes can be turned off. They can be turned off. Just as the mind can settle down into stillness, into joy. Same. Exactly the same. All it takes is effort. That's all. So, Muhammad made the people believe that he could call a mountain to him and from the top of it offer up his prayers for the observers of his law. The people assembled. Muhammad called the mountain to come to him again and again, and when the mountain stood still, he was never a whit abashed, but said, if the mountain will not come to Muhammad, the Muhammad will go to the mountain. You can do it. You can do it. And the mountain ain't going to come to you unless you do it. Sorry, it ain't going to come. And as I've been teaching the last couple of years, I've been emphasizing that when stuff comes into our minds and our meditation that really clogs us up emotionally, the way to dislodge that coagulation and that emotional pain is to experience what's happening in our bodies, to come back to our bodies, notice the sensations related to whatever it is, and find them in our bodies and just be with them. We'll notice they change. We'll notice they don't stay coagulated in our bodies. We notice they move. We notice that they disperse. It's a good practice. It's a good practice. So we need to remind ourselves too when that we're many selves, that we're many different selves, and that sometimes we're going to be the anxious self, and sometimes the needy self, and sometimes the enthusiastic self. We're many selves. And we can honor all those selves, just as we can honor all the animals in our zoo. These are all the animals in our zoo. Let's honor them. Whoa, I wish I didn't have that monkey in my zoo. I just would like to have the calm rhinoceros. Got the monkey in your zoo. Take care of it. You're a multiplicity of selves. So Rumi says, be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Each just gives us an opportunity to be with ourselves and tap into a quiet joy that's just here. It's just here. And of course, as a psychologist, I've talked about this before, my early training, we were trained about three inner selves, right? The inner child, little Tim. Little Tim wants everybody to like him. He's 71 years old. He's the guiding teacher here, but he hopes he'd give me a good enough talk. He hopes somebody will say he gave a good talk. He's been giving these talks for years. It's his life, but oh, is he good enough? Will people like him? Do they want him here? Mama! Mama! Where's my mama? Right? Little Tim has written a book, and he's going to California to speak at all the Dharma centers about his book. Where's my mama? I'm going out there all by myself? Ben did it. But I need a mama. The little child in us. That little child's always there. It's always there. And then there's the internal parent. Cut that shit out. Cut that shit out and get on your cushion. You're supposed to be growing up by now. You're the head Zen teacher in the Minnesota Zen meditation. Come on. Come on. Cut it out. Move on. Move on. You shouldn't be like that. What kind of a role model are you for these guys? What kind of a role model are you? Cut it out. Right? The internal parent. The internal parent. And then the third one is ego, which is trying to deal with the conflict between this child and this parent. How can I manage it? I don't want the parent to beat up on the child, but I don't want the child to go berserk eating all the sugar in the pantry because he's so needy he's going to eat the whole honey jar. My doctor's got me on this diet for my Lyme disease, and I try to go for how many days I'm supposed to journal every day how much, and you know, I'm not supposed to have any sugar or honey. Last night I had half a dessert. The night before I had cookies. Ooh! Right? The little ego is trying to run between these two. That's a multiplicity of selves. It's not bad. It's what we are. It's not what we are. And it's embedded in joy. It's embedded in joy, all this stuff. So in our practice, we're opening our hearts. We're opening our hearts to all this, to this multiplicity of selves, to this multiplicity of pain, this multiplicity of confusion and love and erotic attraction and repulsion and all that stuff. We're opening. Pema Chodron said, the heart is a sea anemone. When you get close to it, it closes to protect its softness. It does. It closes. It's a self-protective mechanism to close, to shut down. But through our zazen, we can learn to open it back up and discover the profound joy that's just here. So this is our lineage. We talk about the lineage in Buddhism. Sounds like a big deal. But from teacher to student, helping the student tap into that joy. And then when the teacher sees it, and the student, it helps the teacher remember that it's with him too. So he can let go of his internal parent, or her internal parent. That's it. That's it. That's it. So, please try to slow down in any way you can. Please hang out with folks who you care about, not be too cut off. Folks who share your values, not be too isolated. Please pay attention to when you're caught by consumer culture or just wanting more cookies. Please build a house of belonging. So what we're trying to do here is build a house of belonging here by Lake Calhoun. A house of belonging. So we can support each other. So we can support each other. Please do fun things. What better way to manifest your timeless joy than to do fun things? And if you're going to watch TV, spend at least half of your time watching comedies. Maybe three quarters of your time. Maybe seven eighths of your time. I'm serious. I'm really serious about this. So when I was at my sickest with my Lyme disease, which has gone on and off for a long time, and now I'm at my healthiest, I said to Linda, "Linda, I want to watch Laurel and Hardy." She said, "Well, I can't help you." But I went online. I'm not a dummy. And I started watching Laurel and Hardy every day. Every day I watched. I would do my lying down meditation because I couldn't sit up, you know, in my snuggly bed meditation. And then I would watch Laurel and Hardy. I'm old. You guys maybe not even know who Laurel and Hardy is. But there's someone like that now, isn't there? Someone who's joyful and they're sort of their comedy. I don't know. There must be. So, somebody said that all Zen is Buddhism with jokes. Somebody said that. Are you the one who said that, Guy? I think maybe it was Guy who said that. So, do Zazen, do meditation. Do retreats. Try to do more than 2 days sometimes because of our electronic circuit and how hardwired it is. And you'll become an expert in joy too. But you won't feel like you're an expert in joy. But other people will feel that way when they're around you. Other people will. Other people will. So I think Thoreau was right, don't you? Surely, joy is the condition of life. And if you read about Thoreau's life, he spent a lot of time being meditative. A lot of time. It took a lot of determination. Everybody thinks Thoreau is so cool, but in his time, the things that he did were very suspicious. Many people thought he was very weird. Very weird. So don't be afraid to be very weird. Don't be afraid. So I'd like to finish with an invocation that goes along with the immeasurable of joy. And I don't think... is it in your programs? Yep. Oh, yeah. So it's in your programs. So if you have programs, you could pick it up, your programs up. But I'm gonna read it and then if you want to you can repeat it with me three times. If you'd rather not, that's fine too. So I'll read it. May I enjoy the activities of life. May I enjoy things just as they are. May I experience the world taking joy. I'm gonna do it by myself and then it will all be. May I experience the world taking joy in all that I do. May I freely respond to whatever arises. So do this as you like, and if you like to do gassho, fine. If you don't want to do gassho, fine. May I enjoy the activities of life. Man, joy, things just as they are. May I experience the world taking joy in all that I do. May I freely respond to whatever arises. May I enjoy the activities of life. May I enjoy things just as they are. May I experience the world taking joy in all that I do. May I freely respond to whatever arises. One more time. May I enjoy the activities of life. May I enjoy things just as they are. May I experience the world taking joy in all that I do. May I freely respond to whatever arises. Okay, so there's a little bit of time. If people have questions or comments. Questions, comments, stories, songs, jokes.
The Marx Brothers.
The Marx Brothers? Oh, okay. I'm sure they're online too, right?
Yeah.
Well, what isn't online? He's recommending the Marx Brothers for those guys who couldn't hear. What else? What else? Questions, comments? Yeah.
I had a joyful experience over the weekend. I was with some friends doing karaoke. I normally don't do it in a bar because people are really good, especially the VFWs. So I normally don't do it. But I wanted to sing a song from My Fair Lady, and it was awful. I didn't care. It was wonderful.
Good for you. Good for you. What else? Yeah.
Last week, Stephanie apologized before she stated her question, and I would like to deeply apologize.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yesterday, as I was coming out of Target, I saw a black woman wearing a Black Lives Matter pin. And she was coming in, I was going out, and I said, "Excuse me, where did you get that pin? I've been looking for one."
Mm-hmm.
She turned around, and we were a couple of feet from each other, and she said, Oh, a woman gave it to me a couple of weeks ago. Actually, I'm homeless. I could sell you the pin."
Mm.
And I reached into my pocket, pulled up my wallet, and opened it up. I had $21 in it.
Mm.
And I said, "Normally I don't do this, but I gave her a $20 bill."
Mm-hmm.
And she gave me a pin.
Mm.
And she teared up at that point.
Mm.
And she said, "Thank you.
Mm.
Now I can get something to eat."
Mm-hmm.
"God bless you."
Mm-hmm.
And we went on our ways.
Mm-hmm.
Separately. And by the time I got home, I was thinking to myself, why couldn't I now have her pin? How important was this pin to her to broadcast this message to the world?
Mm.
She no longer has it.
Mm-hmm.
I have it.
There
was this inequality built into this supposedly free exchange
of
goods. Right? This is capitalism at work. And it bothered me to the point where I was tearing up.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back to Target looking for her, intending to give her back her pin.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, it had taken me too long to figure out what the right thing to do was, so she was gone.
Yeah.
So, you know, here's the problem. Joy is a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, looking at the world, I see this system that we all seem to be embedded in, which is based on exploitation, especially of people of color, but not only them.
Mm-hmm.
And so my question is, you know, here's where the apology comes in.
Yeah, sure.
What, in addition to the generic colorblind Buddhist blah, 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 do we need in order to save all beings?
Well, of course, we need to do lots of things. And you have something that you've been talking to me about doing. I just picked up a while ago the summer program for Tassajara Zen Monastery. And they have stuff on climate change. They've got stuff on racial inequity. They've got stuff on working with homeless. They've got stuff on dealing with mental illness. We need lots of things. lots and lots of things. We can only do so much. We have to choose the ones that resonate with us the most and really work on them. That's part of our bodhisattva practice, and that's joyful. That's joyful to do that. So you're completely right. You're completely right. Time for one more, if there is one more. Yeah, back there.
Hi. Thank you. Could you just elaborate a little bit on how the Zen meditation moved to Minneapolis? Because I did read somewhere it had, we had like the first Zen summit in California. And it was just a little introduction that I had seen somewhere that talked about where the first one was and how it branched out into the country. Could you just elaborate a little bit on how the Zen meditation came into the United States, or you know, just how it became part of the culture?
Oh, yeah. Well, I could do that for 3 hours. Let's see. How can I do that in 2 minutes?
Well, this is just like a five-liner, and I just can't recollect it.
Yeah. Well, see, how do I do this short in a short way? I'll just speak from my personal experience. That way it can be short. So I started Zen practice 51 years ago in San Francisco. At that time, there were this was the beginning of the, just before the counterculture started and the end of the beatnik era. And there, Beat Zen and Square Zen had come out. Jack Kerouac had written On the Road. Alan Watts had written The Way of Zen. Dietz Suzuki had books on Zen. But nobody was really practicing. There were a few little... And there was a Zen teacher named Senzaki, Nyogen Senzaki, who had came over and was a dishwasher in the late 40s, and people found him. And then my teacher, Suzuki, came in 58 and was discovered in the Japanese part of San Francisco in, or was it 59, 60? And I met him in 64 when he was not well known. So these Japanese teachers came over, and there were a few people like Alan Watts and artists and beats like Gary Snyder who went over to Japan. And then we started practicing little by little in San Francisco, little by little. And then all that huge hippie culture came in. But some of those hippies practiced with us, and some of us were those hippies. And now for me to read in Time magazine about Zen meditation and mindfulness, it just blows me away. So that's my 2 minute version. Is that good enough or not?
And you mentioned the name that in the caption that I read, it talked about Suzuki.
Pardon?
It talked about Suzuki.
Yes.
The Zen teacher in the caption that I had read, it talked about, I think this was one of the first Zen centers in Minneapolis.
Yeah, this is really the first Buddhist center in the Midwest. This is Katagiri who did this, Katagiri Roshi, my second teacher, in 1972. We bought this place in 75, which is when I moved into the neighborhood, knowing that they were going to buy this place. I told my wife, you know, we've got to live within a few blocks of here. She said, okay, as long as we don't have to move again. We haven't moved since. So that's a little bit of history. Thank you.